This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Maxine Blyweiss. She's the director of the Westport Library in Westport, Connecticut. I wanted to talk to Maxine because in the course of all these conversations that I've had with people about the publishing business, I realized I never talked to somebody who's actually in and working in a library. And libraries are a crucial element of the publishing and book ecosystem, and also part of American culture. And I thought it would be really important to talk to a librarian. And as it happens, I live near Westport, Connecticut. The Westport Library is a fantastic library with a huge commitment from its community. And a lot of this is due to the work that Maxine has done. So, hi Maxine, how are you?
Hi David, great.
So how long have you been at the Westport Library?
I've been here a lucky 13 years.
And you've been a librarian?
I've been a librarian since 1973, back in the time when it was easy. You just had to know Reader's Guide and what was on the bestseller list that week, and you were good to go.
Right.
And it's a whole different thing today.
So we'll maybe talk about, you know, without going through every detail of the changes over the last 35 years, which there have been, I mean, that's a long time, but how would you, I mean, and there are some things that are obvious that probably people will guess, but I'd be really interested to hear how you see the library in Westport in specific, and then maybe generalize from that how you see the role of libraries changing over the last 30 years, and then maybe we can get to what will happen in the future.
I actually see the role of libraries going back to the beginning, to, you know, one of those first libraries in Alexandria where the scholars came to debate and discuss and learn, and there sure weren't many books on the shelves then. That's what we're seeing in a shift of people coming together as community, looking at themselves as resources. I actually have a little dream that we start cataloging people so that we can bring them together.
So
I think that'd be a lot of fun.
A database of the minds and abilities of all the people in a community.
That's right. That's right. Because that's what we're turning towards. However, I believe Westport is in a unique situation. As you mentioned, we're one of the highest per capita supported libraries in the country, and have a population that makes that happen because they believe so strongly in libraries that if you go back to Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail, we're really a long tail library. We're a place where you're going to find the things you won't find in most libraries. We're kind of part university library, part public library, so because of the people who are here doing research.
So, and how many physical volumes do you have in the library? That used to be a question every library would have to answer right away.
It did, and it's a hard thing to answer, but physical things, we have about 225,000 for a population of 26,000.
Right. Although you can access libraries in a much broader sphere than
we access over 400 items a month for people from just this community, and we're kind of off the charts because we're the eighth highest circulating public library in all of New England, and we're 134th in population. But we circulate almost a million items from this place every year. About 1,600 people walk in the doors every day. But we also have about 1,200 programs, which is bringing people together to learn in new ways. I really contend that libraries and librarians kind of got into trouble in the past few years when they started to worry more about the inanimate objects that were on the shelf, keeping them in order, getting them back on time, fines, that kind of grouchy stuff. Instead of the people who were checking them out. And it's almost a little bit freeing now as we're going towards electronic content that we don't have to worry about those things.
Right. Although you have to worry about the access and the tools and the technology. I mean, that's a whole new set of issues. But I think we'll get to those in the course of the conversation.
Great.
I'm really interested in the idea of what you've described as the library as a, you know, it's in the most basic sense a community, but I think people often think of libraries as a community where people come to get resources that they can't get anywhere else. And what you're talking about is not just the resources, but the bringing together of people in different ways. Now, maybe you can talk about the 12, and also for, you know, people, I know people who will hear this will say, well, not every library can do that. Not every library has the community support that Westport has. So is this something that could apply in other places? I suspect that you could make the argument that absolutely you can do this with a different set of financial resources. It's not the money per se that drives your ability. It's, you know, it becomes almost a kind of synergy between you and the community that it theoretically, I would say, a library could drive itself into that role and become crucial to the community.
Oh, absolutely. It takes some imagination and attitude and a desire to do it. It's bringing people together is probably the least expensive aspect of running a library.
Which is, I mean, that's a good thing.
It is.
To say.
It is.
Now, when the 1,200 programs, can you, I obviously don't want you to talk about every single one, but what broadly, you know, that I know you have amazing author events. You have them regularly and constantly.
We do.
But what else? I mean, I know a lot of children's events, too.
We do. What we try to do is reflect whatever is on people's minds, whatever they need to know. Right now, we're having a lot of programs in the area of technology. It's a program on cloud computing next week. There was a program on tablet PCs last week. And again, because of where we are, we were lucky to bring Michael Miller, who is the editor of PC Magazine, here to talk about that. We David Pogue lives here, the New York Times, so we have him come and talk about that. So it's really picking up on what people want to know. And in a library, we're lucky because we have all those people every day talking to us. And you can kind of aggregate those questions and say, all right, if we've had 5 questions on what's going on in Libya, then let's bring in someone to talk about it. It's a hint of right. What's on people's minds. So we're really lucky.
Right. You use the, I mean, that actually is interesting. You can use the direct questions that people ask you as a kind of ear to the ground. That's very active and very current.
Right, right. We consider
those. But
then
you have to respond quickly because things change so fast.
We do. I've often thought of setting aside a time every month for the topic of the month.
and then let it be whatever it is on that day.
We haven't quite gotten to that yet, but we do it with books. Once a month we have a book group led just about what you're reading as opposed to a book discussion group on a particular book. And
so, I mean, people can come in and talk about what they're reading, not necessarily all the same book.
That's right. That's right.
Is that the one that
Nina Sankovic leads? That's right. Yeah.
So, and would you say that the events that you run, now you run a lot in the evenings that are for adults, right, during the day?
Daytime, too.
As well.
Daytime, too.
And do you get more senior citizens during the day then, or is it kind of still
It's all topic related. People will come out for the topic that they want to know about, no matter when it is. Practically, we average about 75 people per program. So sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more, and sometimes you want it to be less so that you can have more discussion time. Another thing that's kind of fun, a different spin on programs is it used to be programs started say at noon and they were over by 1:30 and everybody was gone. Now people are coming earlier and they're staying later. Because they want that community connection. And the later part is people who identify someone who asked an interesting question or made an interesting comment, they want to make connections with them after. So the library as connector is really, really important.
Right.
It's a new phase.
Is that less true of the bigger events where you have a speaker come in the evening? Would you have fewer people sticking around and talking to each other because it wasn't a discussion, it was more
People keep going in the parking lot, they decide to go to the local watering hole, whatever, they just keep it going. And then they'll bump into each other in the grocery store and say, hey, I saw you at, and another conversation starts.
Right.
So that's really good. Something that we do that many libraries do is a town-wide read. We declare the month of January for reading the same book, and that book has to have lots of topics to it. So that's also been an exciting part. I knew you were just going to ask what was the one for this past January.
Well, if you can't remember, that's all right. But you have lots of other books on your mind at any given moment, no doubt. But how long have you been doing the townwide reads?
We've been doing it for about 9 years. This last year we read Zaytoun by Dave Eggers.
Oh, yeah.
And talked about Katrina and New Orleans and all the things that happened in New Orleans, but also religion and all the things that book and that event brought up in people's lives. So it was a good choice. I find that Westport Reads is not about the book. It's about the topics that come up as a result of the book.
So you have to choose the book carefully.
Very carefully.
Talking points that will.
This is the first time that we chose nonfiction, and in the past we've stayed with fiction because you can go all over the place with fiction. Nonfiction tends to keep you in one spot. This particular book didn't. So we bent our own rule, but we're probably back looking for fiction again.
When you do that. How many people do you read the books?
Oh.
Do you think?
Hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. We don't even know because people get their books in a variety of ways. We know how many books are checked out of the library or downloaded.
How do you manage that? Do you have to bring in a really large number of copies
temporarily? Yes.
How do you do that? Do you talk to the publisher?
Well, they're happy to sell us all the books they can, but we find a sponsor for it, and that sponsorship provides for buying multiple copies, and we'll put in 200 copies of any particular book. One year we chose The Wizard of Oz, and we didn't have to do that many copies because many people had that on their shelf at home. And then what we do at the end of the time is we give it away to either a place that is in need of books just in general or a place that wants to do that book next.
Right. So
and they take our formula.
Recycle the books.
Yeah, and they'll sometimes replicate some of what we've done, and that's a good feeling too. But one of the special things I like about when we declare a book to read, first of all, people wait, and that's kind of funny to me. I mean, we're a community of huge readers that they're waiting for us to declare the book. But then people will connect, say, with grandchildren on the West Coast, and they'll read it at the same time and have something to talk about. It really becomes a great catalyst for conversation.
Right. And do you talk to other towns that are reading the same book? I mean, does that ever come up?
Oh, sure. We all talk about it, and we also have learned how our community might be a little different than another community,
right,
and what works best here.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. The nature of Westport is fairly unusual. I mean, there are many towns like this around the country, but they stand out as having an intellectual bent and a population that is well enough to do that. They're able, they seem to be more interested in the intellectual life of the community. But there are a lot of towns which are, also equally well-to-do, but don't have that interest in the intellectual life of the community. And so maybe what is it you think that distinguishes Westport from, I don't even want to pick the name of a town, but you can name a town that has just as much money, but doesn't have the same attitude about the library or about books or learning or art or music.
I think it's openness and curiosity and having enough self-confidence to say, I want to learn. I'll never forget a woman who was probably well into her 90s who showed up on a lecture by the author of a biography of Basquiat. And she said, I have no idea what I'm walking into, but I can't wait to find out. And I kind of crossed my fingers and thought, I hope this is okay, this marriage of this woman coming into this particular talk. And she left smiling, so that was good. But people walk in wanting to know. So it's the admission of wanting to learn more and not feeling like you have to be closed in and say, okay, I got my degree and I, have attained this in my life and I'm all set. You're never all set in Westport.
Right. So how, if you were, let's say, a librarian came to you from a town which had, and I'll take it as an example, a town that had not as many financial resources as Westport does, but an interest in trying to replicate what you've done on a, on a fairly tight budget, what would you advise that librarian to do? How would you cast them or give them advice to cast their activities in a way that would make the library as crucial and central to the intellectual life of its community as possible.
It's turning to the people in the community, or peripheral to the community, who will come in and share and spark that discussion and that conversation and that learning that just happens when you bring people together. And then you have to kind of set the ground rules so that people are polite and they will carefully listen and consider what someone else is saying. I think one of our biggest challenges is in the Q&A part of any of our programs is getting people to really have a Q, not an A, when they stand up.
Right. You want to encourage people to take that chance of standing up and asking a question.
Yeah.
So do you think that, we know that many bookstores around the country have closed, and in years past, bookstores were considered important cultural meeting places in the way we've been talking about. Westport used to have, right in the downtown, two really great bookstores, and over the years actually a third, and now has none in the downtown. And most communities in America don't have good bookstores anymore. Do you feel that role has shifted? In other words, the library picks up that interest in books that a bookstore might have engendered. I mean, do you think that libraries now shift some of their interest to, selling books, not just, because I know some libraries are having stores. They have, you have coffee and you have pastries, you try to make it a place where people can come and stay for a while.
That's right,
so you're
that's
offering
right.
other services than just the books or the electronic products themselves.
Well, I think it's that natural progression from libraries being an errand to a destination. It used to be a 5-minute in and out kind of thing, and now it's a place to stay. But what that requires is the librarians to think of the space and what are we providing and what are we saying when you walk in the door, that we want you to stay and that we want you to have these conversations. That takes making sure that you've got the space to do that, because there should be conversations going on all over the space and people learning in different ways. I think we were kind of pushed into action when learning changed. Kids in school now learn in groups. Businesses now operate in teams. It's just natural that people want to come together to learn, especially as they're able in this kind of community to live in fairly isolated situation. The longer the driveway, the less likely it is that you know your neighbor. And the library is kind of that leveling democratic meeting ground where...
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't actually thought of we talk a lot and I know about crowdsourcing and open source.
Yes.
As, it's certainly part of a lot of our lives. But I hadn't the link between that and the library hadn't actually occurred to me that in business you have people thinking and they get their information from online resources like Wikipedia, which are now pretty predominant in terms of replacing authority models, and so the library what you're describing is a library which is kind of flattening the relationship. So instead of being a hierarchical authority model, you're also going out to, and you that was the first thing you said, is essentially what a good marketer should do today, which is listen, ask questions, and find out what people want before you decide I have this really great idea for a service is not really the best approach. The best approach is I should find out what people want.
That's right. That's right.
I think, that's a learning curve for a lot of people who have been taught that, innovation comes from within rather than from the group.
I always feel blessed when someone says to us, I'm thinking about, or I'm just discovered a new author, or it's like a hot tip. We also work on the concept of librarian as curator.
Right.
Because, again, as things are kind of disappearing somewhat from the shelves, and how are you going to find out that they exist? You've got to still see things and have things brought to your attention
right.
in a non-commercial way.
Opposed to in many online venues, their messaging is bought and paid for.
That's right.
People are actually pretty attuned to that. They know that selection is not necessarily, how should we say, neutral.
That's right. And also as the sections of book review sections of newspapers go the way of, you know, extinction, who are you going to turn to?
Right. Well, I think for publishers, it's a big issue right now.
It is.
The traditional model over the last 30 years has been that you basically put books in stores and libraries and then create PR and media that calls those books to the attention of readers who hopefully will go there and discover them when they happen to walk into the store. It wasn't a great, you know, really great way of marketing books to begin with, but the issue of being able to walk into a store and discover has always been a big plus for a lot of readers. I see it by accident, and we've all done this many times. We've done it in libraries all our lives. You know, walking through the shelves, you see books that you just didn't know existed before, and by having them in front of you, you have the opportunity to look at them.
That's right. That's serendipitous.
I love that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do.
Yeah.
But if bookstores are, shall we say, declining or going away, and libraries are moving away from the physical book on the shelf to an electronic system, you are then faced with the same thing that all online browsing is faced with. It doesn't work the same way. The serendipity of online discovery is much more challenging.
Yes.
Because it hasn't been created yet.
Yeah.
And we need sort of digital versions of what is in the analog world.
Right, right. And I remember in the old days, reference collections used to have dummy books because they'd have the most current of that particular volume behind the desk. And in its place on the spine would be, you know, for most current edition of this particular thing. See the librarian.
Why'd they do that?
Theft.
Right. That's what I thought. I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah.
So, well, let's talk about digital because it sort of is always there as an interesting question. Digital makes almost everything available on some level if you have the right access and ability. You know, so if you're, in other words, ebooks are easier to make available in some ways than print books.
In theory.
So, but the challenge, obviously many challenges for libraries in terms of digital publishing. If I publish a print book, I put it in, you know, Baker & Taylor will sell it to you, you have a physical copy,
yep.
You put it in your library. If I publish an ebook, the models are still being built and kind of evaluated and threshed out. I know there was a lot of controversy recently about HarperCollins putting a limitation on the number of times that you would be able to borrow a book and then saying that after those views have been exhausted, you'd have to buy the book again, which certainly runs counter to our thinking about ownership and sharing. But the digital world is really more like software where we license it, the use of
That's right.
the book rather
That's
than
right.
owning it. And that concept is very difficult to absorb into our thinking since we're so used to the previous model, shall we say.
But it's really more like the service that we have of being able to access articles online.
Yes.
That those are...
Yeah, you buy a right to
You buy a right
up,
to
A license
it.
To them.
Exactly,
and
exactly.
So,
and I think HarperCollins actually did us a big favor because they opened up a huge debate. They clearly wanted to start the conversation, not end it with that, and they're open to think of different ways. But, you know, some people in the library profession were talking about boycotting HarperCollins and things like that. I think they should have spent a whole lot more time talking about Simon & Schuster and Macmillan, which won't... give you zero times, not
right.
It's a whole lot less than 26.
So what do you, as a librarian, thinking ahead, what would you like to see? What's the ideal world for a library in the digital space in terms of accessibility and how, I mean, what model would work for you, would work best?
Well, the best model is that the person is able to have, libraries are all about access. That's the bottom line. So, but access to someone like you may be different than someone like me. Someone who can see versus someone who needs to hear better than they read. Someone who's traveling and on the run versus someone who has to own something and want to keep track of what it is that they're reading. So we're really sort of charged with having a variety of ways to give access to people. And libraries have been pretty darn good at that over the years. We haven't bumped up against so many lawyers and so much technology. I mean, it's the lawyers and the technology part that are getting in the way. Libraries and publishers did just fine when it was just the two of us at the on the dance floor. And now we've added two more partners.
Well, you know, in the film world, I know that the solution that DVD manufacturers came up with for rentals and libraries was to charge a higher amount and then give unlimited use.
Yeah.
In other words, I can't remember what the deal was, but you could buy a brand, you know, the movie that Blockbuster had, they probably paid $80 or $90 for, rather than the $25 that you would pay for it in retail.
Well, and then they went to licensing. We have a site license to show those movies also, which is different than borrowing.
Does it have a limit on the number of times, or is it just...
No, it's about audience, size of audience and space.
So they base it on the demographics. So is that a model that would work for books, do you think?
Probably not. Maybe. Actually, I haven't thought about that. Yeah. That would be a good thing to think about. Right now, the one big model out there is by one particular company, which we have not chosen to go with.
Is that Overdrive?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because that model is based on buying X number of copies, just like we do physical copies, and then if those copies are out, you get on a waiting list.
Right.
To me, that seems crazy in that
because
for that
what,
medium.
What you're doing there is trying to copy the physical world in the digital.
That's right.
When the digital is supposed to be different.
That's right.
It opens, and what you're seeing, I think, is friction created by publishers and other companies because they don't know what will happen. What's a business model that would work if there was no restriction?
That's right.
If every library could have, if you could go to Overdrive and simply loan, you pay whatever you pay, and you can loan that book out infinitely to the, you know, to a 20 people could take it at the same time. They don't know how they make money doing that. Now, I can think of ways you could do it. Since it's a digital object, if 20 people took it out, you could charge 2 cents each time somebody took it out.
Well, and that's the model we're looking at. We're working with a company that is hopefully going to bring that product to market this summer, where everybody could be downloading the same book at the same time, and we are paying per use.
Right.
When you think about it, libraries do a lot of buying just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And right, I'd rather buy just in time.
Right, this would say, well, that's the digital offers you the ability. You don't have to worry about whether somebody is going to want to read it or not, and therefore pay for a physical book that might sit there for years. I mean, great long tail positioning, but really not efficient with taxpayer dollars.
That's right.
So theoretically, the most efficient thing is to have access to all books all the time and only pay for the books that people actually read when they read them.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Now, and of course,
that's what we're holding out for.
Right.
And
of course, that model might actually
bring.
Also work for a publisher and the reader, the ultimate reader. Why couldn't I, if I'm a heavy reader, buy the same license from an Amazon or whomever else would be the aggregator and say, I want access to all books all the time. I don't want to pay $9.99 and then have this. Once I've bought it, I can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
I
can't even loan it to somebody, although now they're beginning to offer loaning. And if they're going to offer loaning, then they're sort of offering the general consumer some of the same things that a library needs.
Well, I expect books to take on a different quality. They're going to become more special, rarer.
The print books. Yes, I
the
agree.
P-book. The
right.
the paper, the type, the illustrations. I mean, I think we're going to revere that more.
Right. Well, it will be more precious because it will be rarer.
That's right.
And that if information is flat, then the object, which is not flat, has some special power and meaning. It almost becomes totemic.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet. there, and I don't think we will be there for quite some time because there are so many people who are living today who are buying lots of books who still feel like they want print books.
Well, and I was speaking to a 29-year-old voracious reader last night who said, you know, I look at a screen all day long at work. I don't want, and her reading is mostly for pleasure when she sits down with a book. So she said, I don't want to do it that way. I mean, it's a differentiation that we can't totally.
No, that's true. And if your work life is very dominant for people, and it is all on screens today. So for relaxation, you want to do something different. It's as if, you know, you spend your whole day in an office. You want to go swimming at night.
Well, or picking what chair you want to sit in. You're not going to sit in a straight back chair all day. You're going to want to
relax
at some point and put your feet up.
You want to differentiate work from pleasure.
Right.
So one of the key ways of doing that would be to hold a physical.
Right. It's just like you wear maybe different clothes at different parts of your day.
But what I think is clear is that there are different strata. There are many voracious readers who've said, I'm reading all digital now. It saves me a ton of money. I don't have to carry books around. I don't have to fill up my house with books, which is a big issue for a lot of people. And then there are people who feel the way you just described. They want nothing to do with electronic reading. They only want to read books as physical objects.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there are probably variations in between.
Yes.
There are people who will read digitally sometimes and print others. There are people who will read, and I think the definition of a book is going to change because shorter forms, which were, you know, really have been almost made obsolete by the technology of and the economics of publishing, are now coming back in digital form. You know, short stories, big revival.
Poetry,
although the e-layouts of poetry have to be resolved because there are a lot of versions of poetry on the screen that look really bad because of the nature of the display. But then there also are certain kinds of books that I think are more suited to digital that ultimately the print will go away.
You know, I was all excited thinking we could just take our travel guide section
right,
down
just
to nothing.
Throw it away.
Just throw it away. So I downloaded Fodor's London when I was there to a device. It was awful. I mean, you flip in a travel guide.
Right.
Now, I mean, it just didn't work at all.
If you have, let's say you were doing a long trip and you're going to several places, do you really want to carry 6 books? And then each one, when you're done, what do you do with it?
Well, I remember in the old days when you'd get the Let's Go guide as you were tromping around Europe and all those countries, and you'd just tear off every place
right,
that you were
that.
Going. Done
gone.
With that country,
right.
that it's
right.
gone away. And that was kind of the best of both worlds.
Well, and for some people, I think they feel that what was formerly suited to a book is more likely to be on the web. And I don't mean as necessarily... it may not be a full one-to-one replacement, but there are things you can do on the web that you can't do in a physical
way. Oh, sure. And the whole GPS
right.
thing and reviews and right. currency
and,
of
and,
it is very exciting.
And the interactivity part, you know, there are, you can, as if you're interested in doing this, you can write your own travel diary.
Yeah,
you can essentially create your own guide.
But, you know, back to your question about the programs that we're doing, we're back in the literacy business. Where I go back to the early 1900s, where the kids were often the ones who knew how to speak the language, and the parents relied on the kids to interpret the forms they had to fill out, or the government stuff they had to negotiate, or whatever. It's certainly become the same here, and for a while it didn't matter. It was okay to joke and say, well, I have to wait till my 12-year-old grandson comes to program my VCR.
Right.
But now everybody needs to know something. It's not just if you're in school or if you're in business. You really do. You need to know how to Skype to see your grandchildren in another country or another part of the world. So the library is kind of taking on, or this library is, that role that maybe the Apple Genius Bar has, mm-hmm. and inviting people to come in. But instead of, you know, the 20-something-year-old who might be a little intimidating just by their age and vocabulary, we're the same librarians that you've seen for day in and day out for years, who are maybe 5 minutes ahead of you, but one or two steps ahead of what you need to know. And we're kind of slogging through this together because we care, because it's a community. And, you know, I'm fond of saying that there's no Mr. and Mrs. Google at the other end who's there to answer your question that you've put into any search bar. But librarians care and,
right, and also
want you to be successful.
Right, the questions you can ask online are not necessarily going to solve your problem. They might get you information,
yes.
but there's not
yes.
it's not necessarily expertise.
Yeah.
And also,
yeah.
if you're
yeah.
not comfortable with online in the first place, then you can't use those tools. I
right.
think of that sometimes when I see the electric company says, you know, go to our site and, you know, do your complaining there or whatever it is. Well,
yeah.
if your power's out, you can't go there.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's
yeah.
similarly.
It's
you
true.
Know, you can't say to people, oh, go online and all the answers are there if they haven't yet figured out how to go online or if they don't have access. I mean, that's
right,
the other
right.
thing that libraries, I know, are important in many communities. Not everybody has a computer.
Oh.
Not everybody has high-speed internet. And
then there are viruses.
Yeah.
Those things that come along. We've had people show up who have wonderful systems at home but that just aren't working. And we're often kind of the rescue squad. We rescue a lot of people when
so you mean
there's a deadline.
They can't get access,
they can't,
so they come in here.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
And
do
you have to worry at all about the use of your computers? I know this is like a big issue or at least it was during the height of the 9/11 period. You know, everybody was worried about. But you don't worry about people. I mean, people come in, they use your terminals. There's no supervision or anything.
You know,
like
I think a lot of it stems from being close to your customer. It's sort of like the whole shoplifting thing. You know, you greet someone at the door, you have a conversation with them, you stay attached to them. It's harder for people to steal from you if you've just looked them in the eye, and so it's the same thing. It's harder for bad behavior to happen, whether you're talking about potentially rowdy teenagers. If you know their names and you know who their parents are, you know it's a lot easier to manage. And,
well,
and same
goes
same with
back
that.
Back to the idea of a community.
That's right.
People who
That's
are
right.
in a community literally are responsible for each other.
Yeah.
So it's more likely that you'll have mutuality.
Yes.
In
yes.
both directions.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, so thinking about the future for libraries, I mean, obviously you have laid out a key pathway, which is to think in terms of community and to ask the people who are, you know, in your community what they want and then provide them with those things. That's a pretty good principle to operate under. So the future, if you do that, then the future unfolds itself and people will tell you what they want. But if you're thinking about, do you envision the whole electronic access thing being resolved, you know, where it's going to be possible for you to offer books to your patrons electronically without as many restrictions as there are, you know, at the current time?
Maybe well, you're talking to kind of a Pollyanna here. So I do. If people want to stay in business, mm-hmm. there are still wonderful authors out there. I mean, no part of the chain is going away. So, and luckily the authors just keep coming. And that's such a gold mine of stuff that we all want to read, and it's like a feeding frenzy. So it behooves the legal folks and the tech folks to get together. But I think what's most important, if I were to ask the publisher, to have far more conversations with people like librarians who are really seeing the people who need their product in a way that is less commercial than the bookstore folks. I think they'd feel a little more comfortable with getting into that arena.
Do you see that happening? Do you think that when you go to ALA this June, that you will have more conversations with publishers?
I stop by and talk to all of them, but you can bet I'll be more at the Macmillan and Simon & Schuster folks than anyone. And I know that HarperCollins will work hard to make this happen, because they've got the right attitude. They're just taking little baby steps towards
speaking
it.
Speaking of authors, because I think that more and more I'm seeing, this whole, the concept of self-publishing, which has been around for many, many years. Mm-hmm. People have published their own books for years. Independent presses, many of them started out as tools to get books published that no one else would do. And some of them are good and some of them are not, but then some HarperCollins books are good and some are not. And some, no publisher has a certainty that all of their books are really great or mm-hmm. will succeed. Mm-hmm. But today, the tools for authors and people who work with them to make books available without reference, without going through a publisher, a traditional publisher or even any publisher, it's now overwhelmingly easy. You have not only the CreateSpace and the Lulu and the Blurb of the world, but you also have now with ebooks, I think more and more, and I'm certainly hearing this from authors, they want to publish their own books. Partially because they read about people like John Locke and Amanda Hocking and C.A. Conrath and Barry Eisler, and they think, well, why can't I just go on Amazon and publish my own book in the Kindle format? It's pretty easy to do. How does that, there's a hole there in the relationship between the consumer and the book if libraries are not part of that conversation. And as far as I can see, there isn't a hole. There isn't anything.
No, and there's a big space between being a great writer or someone writing something that people need to know about and knowing how to bring it to market. Mm-hmm. They don't usually lie in the same person. So we're just creating a new market for marketers of people who are self-publishing, and they then are the ones who need to know about libraries. It does fascinate me sometimes when people who are creating things forget about the place where they first learned about reading, which for many people was the public library. It's like, okay, that was then, this is now, and I have faith that it'll circle back to that place that gave you mm-hmm. what you needed to go on to become that writer. But I think the self-publishing world will work itself out, because people are very discerning. They will know what's good and what's bad. An industry that I just heard a fascinating talk on was the romance industry. Mm-hmm. How that is seeing a real uptick in sales because of ebooks, because people had been embarrassed to be seen reading something with the covers. That romances have.
Because the voracious reader who might read three or four a week has found that ebooks are less expensive. And if you really have a heavy-duty reading habit and you can pay $4.99 instead of $8.99 or
$10.99,
or even just the work of going to the library to get a book every day. For people who read that much, I think ebooks have been very effective.
Well, there's so many ways to get P-books cheaper, also that libraries have to have the added value of conversation and curation. And the thing that makes you feel good by walking into the space, and for some people, they walk into the space and they just want to kind of nod and smile at somebody, maybe not smile even, and go away into the corner and hide, but be in a space with other people. I kind of call it adult parallel play. They're motivated they feel good. People have told me that their blood pressure goes down and their IQ goes up when they walk into library space. And those are things you can't put a price tag on.
No, I think that's a good, it's a good model, or it's a good way of thinking about what a library can be.
Yes.
When we say the word community, I think we bundle under that a lot of the values and meanings that you've described here in more detail, which I think are important. Just saying community doesn't really communicate enough.
No.
Well, I trust that Westport will do very well in the future. In this model. I think it's really, you know, clearly working.
Well, here. People come to this library from all over because they want to sort of, you know, drink the water, whatever it is that's spawning all this talent here. They don't have to live in Westport. Anybody can walk into any library. Yeah. And in Connecticut right now, thanks to hopefully a budget that will continue to be appropriated by the General Assembly, people can use any public library in Connecticut that they want with their hometown library card. So we see people, there are 169 towns in Connecticut. We see people in the past year from checking out books from 105 of those 169 towns.
No, that's impressive.
And we're hardly geographically central.
No, this is that's I think very important. That's meaningful.
It is. It is. It's a higher obligation that we have, and we recognize that we do, and it's fun doing it.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Maxine.
Sure, David.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I've been talking to Maxine Bleiweiss. She's the director of the Westport, Connecticut Public Library. Thank you.